You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 139, Le Brutal. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking our Patreon supporters. This project would not be viable without audience support. Thank you for keeping it afloat. As for the rest of you, I would ask you to once again consider supporting this project, and any other independent media you enjoy. In this day and age, independent media projects like this one are only viable with audience support. If you can't contribute financially, please consider leaving a review or sharing on social media. I would also remind you that the bonus episodes are still going strong. I really enjoyed our last installment. We talked about the state of the German language during the Napoleonic era, and the field musicians, the drummers and trumpeters who were responsible for relaying orders on the battlefield, among other topics. If you enjoy the main narrative, I'm sure you'll find the bonus episodes interesting as well. Thank you for considering it. Anyway, in this episode, we'll be setting aside the main narrative to continue a series I started in the very early days of the show, with a guide to the infantry of the Napoleonic era. I continued it a few years later with a guide to the cavalry, and now, in this episode, we will be tackling the last of the three major branches of a Napoleonic army, the artillery. We will be focusing on the French artillery, since they are at the center of our story. But a lot of what you'll be hearing applies more generally, and we will be touching on the artillery services of the other great powers as well. In this era, the artillery was often referred to in poetic terms. Monarchical metaphors were popular. The final argument of kings, or the kings of the battlefield. Other times, it was compared to the weather, the deafening noise of its guns likened to thunder, or their terrifying killing power to a hurricane. In the slang of the Grande Armée, the artillery was le brutal, meaning the brutal, or the brutal one. During the Napoleonic Wars, the prestige of the artillery was higher than ever before. The fact that Napoleon himself had risen through the ranks as an artillery officer probably had something to do with that. But Bonaparte's personal connection is only part of the story. This was an exciting world during the late 18th and early 19th centuries. New technologies, new methods, and new doctrines were appearing all the time. Artillery was to the Napoleonic period what tanks and airplanes were to the mid-20th century. Artillerymen were at the cutting edge of military science of this period, and they knew it. Many of them found it exhilarating. By and large, they were proud of their technical prowess. This attitude itself was on the cutting edge. 100 years after the Napoleonic Wars, in the early and mid-20th century, observers of warfare of this period often commented on the fact that soldiers were beginning to sound almost more like technicians than warriors. They were proud not only of old-fashioned soldierly virtues, but also of very modern benchmarks. Most notably their skills at maintaining and operating their machines and equipment. For example, a soldier in a tank regiment might have been just as likely to brag about his unit's ability to keep their finicky diesel engines in working order as he would be to brag about their bravery. In this respect, the artillerymen of the Napoleonic era anticipated the soldiers of the future. They, too, were technicians as well as warriors. The battlefield tested their bravery, discipline, and toughness, just like the other soldiers of the army, but also their ability to think quickly and multitask under pressure, their skill at operating and maintaining their weapons and equipment, and even their ability to do mathematics on the fly. The artillery was the only major branch of the army that required its officers to achieve high academic performance. As long as you managed to graduate from a military academy, you could become an officer in the cavalry or the infantry, no matter how poor a student you had been. But only those with the very best grades would move on to the artillery. As we saw in our early episodes, Napoleon himself only barely made the cut, and he was actually a pretty good student. The artillery was considered the least glamorous of the three branches of service. Young officers who were interested in chasing glory and social status sought out positions in the cavalry or the elite guards infantry regiments. Under the old regime, officers who gravitated to the artillery tended to be lower on the aristocratic hierarchy, often men like Napoleon, who came from the bottom rung of the nobility. Pre-revolutionary artillery units also had a higher proportion of commoners in the officer corps than any other branch of the army. The artillery may not have been glamorous, but within its ranks, brains, work ethic, and technical expertise were valued above all else, including where you came from and what your last name was. Under the old regime, intelligent young officers who came from less wealthy or prominent families recognized that if they worked hard, they could carve out good careers in the artillery. Doors were open for them in this branch of the army that might have been closed in the infantry or cavalry. Given their origins and more cerebral, modern outlook, perhaps it's no surprise that artillery officers were generally more supportive of the revolution than the rest of the officer corps. Many artillery officers did leave the army, or even defect to the coalition during the 1790s, but at nowhere near the same rates as their comrades in the infantry, or especially the cavalry. As for the enlisted men, they were selected primarily for their level of education. During this period, around half of France was illiterate, but it was rare to find an artilleryman who didn't at least have his letters. Most had at least some level of formal education. They were trained in the use of all sorts of artillery. There were no specialists when it came to weapons. Every man in the French artillery was expected to be familiar with every type of gun in the imperial arsenal, from the truly monstrous cannons only found in fortresses to tiny mortars that were almost small enough for a single man to pick up and carry around. The artillery viewed themselves as an elite. In the literal sense of the term, they were not. At least in the French army, elite soldiers received extra pay, and the vast majority of artillery units did not qualify. On the other hand, as we've discussed, artillery officers had to pass rigorous academic standards. The enlisted men were better educated on average, and had to master all kinds of skills that would have been beyond the average Napoleonic soldier. They also had their connection with the emperor. As you're well aware, Napoleon had been educated, trained, then risen through the ranks as an artillery officer. And even after leaving the artillery behind to take command of whole armies, he paid a lot of attention to his home service, famously even personally citing guns during the First Italian Campaign, leading to the first of his many nicknames, the Little Corporal. The connection persisted after his seizure of power. Napoleon ran the staff of the artillery corps personally. As we saw in our early episodes, Napoleon was keenly aware that artillery was the future of warfare. He never lost that sense, even after he ascended out of the service. The other branches of the army generally saw artillerymen as eggheads and know-it-alls, who were maybe not quite real soldiers, and were shown unfair favoritism because one of their own had happened to become emperor. Of course, as we've seen in past episodes, they may have depended on each other on the battlefield, but none of the branches of the army had a very high opinion of the others. The artillery was by far the smallest of the three main components of a Napoleonic army. As we've discussed in past episodes, armies fighting in Europe during this period could be up to 90% infantry, and 10 to 20% cavalry was usually the standard. Obviously, that doesn't leave much room for the gunners. To take one example, at the Battle of Wagram, the largest engagement we've discussed so far in the main narrative, only one out of every 20 French soldiers on the battlefield was an artilleryman. And that was actually quite a bit compared to earlier battles. Throughout the period we've been discussing over the course of this show, there was a trend towards more and more artillery, and that will continue until the end of our story. At Austerlitz in 1805, there were 2 cannons for every 1,000 soldiers, which represented a significant increase over pre-revolutionary battles. By the time of the Battle of Borodino in 1812, there were just shy of 5 guns for every 1,000 soldiers. The ratio had more than doubled in just 7 years. Despite their relatively small numbers, the artillery did a lot of damage. Estimates vary, but in some Napoleonic battles, perhaps as many as 1 out of every 3 casualties was caused by cannon fire. Although that was the absolute maximum, 10 to 20% was much more common. Obviously, cannons had some unique capabilities. They were the only part of the army capable of engaging at long range, and the only part capable of reducing buildings or fortifications from a distance. Every one of the great powers of this period was desperate for more artillery, but they were all limited by the incredible expense and difficulty of manufacturing new cannons, and of maintaining those already in service. Most large countries of this period had at least 1 state-run arsenal that produced artillery pieces for their armies. Some countries also supplemented the production of their state arsenals by subcontracting out to private industry. But uniformity and quality control were so important that a top-down system, run directly by the government, was generally preferred. Even today, in our era of privatization and marketization, a lot of governments prefer to handle their heavy weapons manufacturing directly through state-run enterprises. You might be thinking, how hard could this be? After all, a cannon is essentially just a big metal tube on wheels. But the manufacturing had to be very precise. 1 minor imperfection could lead to a deadly explosion in the field. Every piece of artillery on every Napoleonic battlefield also came with an entire suite of accompanying gear. The tools used by the gunners to load, fire, and clean the piece. The carriage, which held the gun. The wheels. The limber, which was a sort of cart that allowed the gun to be harnessed to a team of horses for movement. And caissons, which are special heavy-duty wagons for carrying ammunition and equipment. All the parts in all of these manufactured items had to be very close to the same size, so they would be interchangeable. Today, we generally don't think of woodworking as being serious manufacturing, but these wooden pieces had to be incredibly tough, capable of holding thousands of pounds of weight over years of rough use. For those of you who are not aware, fresh-cut wood is not suitable for such purposes. It first has to be seasoned, or left to dry and hardened for some set period of time. The French artillery seasoned their wood for decades, ideally up to 30 years. This helps explain why manufacturing was handled by state-run arsenals. That type of extremely long-term planning is difficult for private companies. Later in the Napoleonic Wars, particularly after the Russia campaign, French arsenals began to run through their stocks of seasoned lumber, and had to begin making carriages, limbers, and caissons out of younger and younger wood, which led to quality problems. Just like the cannons themselves, the limbers and caissons all came with their own parts and equipment, which all had to be purpose-built to a high standard. On top of all that, every artillery unit needed a huge array of portable blacksmithing and woodworking tools, just to keep all this complicated gear in working order out in the field. This massive constellation of manufactured goods was all produced in a pre-industrial environment. Each one of the cannons used in this era was something approaching a miracle of organization, engineering, and manufacturing. And we sometimes see hundreds at a time assembled for a single engagement. As we've discussed in past episodes, artillery pieces were classified according to the weight of the shot they fired. So we might refer to an 8-pound cannon, or simply an 8-pounder, which would mean a cannon whose standard round was a cannonball weighing 8 pounds. Field artillery generally ranged between 6 and 12 pounds. In metric, that would be between 2.7 and 5.4 kilograms. Many countries of this era also kept less common types of guns in their arsenals. Light cannons and mountain guns could be as small as 4 or even 3 pounders. Siege guns were typically much bigger than the 12-pounders, which were the heaviest guns in the field artillery. Fortress and naval cannons, which would be stationary for almost their entire careers, could be even heavier. On top of cannons, there were mortars, which have much shorter barrels and are designed to fire in a high arc trajectory, and howitzers, which represent sort of a middle ground between a cannon and a mortar. Each size of gun had its own unique size of carriage, wheels, and limber, which all had to be purpose-built. Just imagine what an organizational nightmare it must have been to maintain separate production and logistics lines for each one of these pieces of equipment. There were two kinds of field artillery, foot artillery and horse artillery. People sometimes assume foot artillery means the gunners were expected to personally move their cannons on foot on the march. That would have been completely impractical. The average Napoleonic-era cannon weighed well over 1,000 pounds. That's about 450 kilograms. The gunners did often move their guns by hand on the battlefield, but only for very short distances. On the march, the foot artillery limbered each one of their guns to a team of horses. They were called foot artillery because the men then marched on foot, like the infantry. In the French army, and all others of this period, the foot artillery made up the vast majority of the service. Most of the foot artillery regiments of the Grande Armée were issued dark blue uniforms, very similar to those worn by their comrades in the infantry. There was also a newer and slightly more glamorous species of gunner, the horse artillery. As you may have guessed from the name, each man in these units was issued with a horse. Obviously, there was no way for them to ride into battle like the cavalry, but their mounts allowed the horse artillery to move much faster on the march. When European militaries first began experimenting with this concept in the decades before the French Revolution, the idea had been that the horse artillery would be able to keep up with the cavalry, providing firepower to fast-moving mounted units. This might have huge implications on the battlefield. Think of the Battle of Alba de Tormes, which we discussed last episode, in which a Spanish army was ambushed by French cavalry. The Patriots had been able to stave off complete disaster by forming squares to hold the cavalry at bay. If the French horsemen had had only a few cannons, they would have been able to blow those squares apart very easily, and would have won a much bigger victory. It was a tantalizing idea, but in practice, the cavalry didn't have to deal with cumbersome wagons and limbered cannons, and so when they really got moving, they always outpaced the horse artillery. However, the horse artillery was significantly faster than foot artillery, and that proved to be useful in all kinds of situations. They could serve as a rapid response force, shoring up the line against an unexpected enemy thrust, or riding forward to support an attack. If part of the army encountered the enemy unexpectedly, a general could at least get his cavalry and horse artillery to the scene relatively quickly, while he waited for the infantry. During the Napoleonic period, the idea of horse artillery was relatively new. Frederick the Great had popularized the concept during the mid and late 18th century. Horse artillery units were not formally organized in the French army until 1792. As you might expect from their role, horse artillery uniforms typically looked more like those of the cavalry than the infantry. In the Grande Armée, they wore uniforms modeled after those of the hussars, with short fur hats and cropped, tight-fitting coats, with the classic web of Eastern European-style braiding down the front. The horse artillery seems to have borrowed some of the attitude of the cavalry as well, they were generally seen as more dashing, or vain and arrogant, depending on your perspective. The horse artillery regiments were also more attractive to new recruits and officer candidates than the foot artillery. Whether horse or foot, the majority of soldiers in the artillery were gunners. As the name implies, the gunners were responsible for firing, loading, and cleaning the cannon in battle. They also limbered and unlimbered their cannon and performed routine maintenance. And I quite deliberately say the cannon in the singular. Each gunner was assigned to a specific piece. In the French army, every company's guns were numbered: first gun, second gun, etc. The men developed attachments to their cannons. To a trained gunner, each piece of artillery almost had a unique personality, each one with its specific quirks. They got used to their cannon's peculiarities and didn't want to learn another's. When commanders of this era ordered their gunners to abandon their cannon, they sometimes refused. A French artillery officer of this era remarked that his men, quote, loved their guns like their sweethearts, end quote. Depending on the unit, nearly 20% of the artillery were what we would call support staff, dedicated technicians who carried out repairs and any more serious periodic maintenance that was not handled by the gunners. Some specialized in metalworking, others in woodworking. There were even a few men who specialized in taking care of the horses, not something we typically think about, but an absolute necessity with so many animals regularly carrying such heavy loads. There were also large numbers of artillerymen stationed behind the lines, or even on the home front. As we've discussed, the artillery branch was responsible for its own weapons production. The men who managed and oversaw cannon manufacturing were soldiers. In past episodes, we've discussed the concept of an artillery park. These were depots where guns not in the field were kept in one centralized location for ease of logistics and maintenance. Obviously, each artillery park needed its own staff. Behind the lines, you would also find the coast guards and fortress troops, many of whom came under the auspices of the artillery. They were part-timers and had little impact on our story. Later in his reign, Napoleon did devote time and resources to improving these rear-guard forces, particularly after the Walcheren campaign, that failed British landing in the Low Countries, which had been foiled primarily by disease. Bonaparte worried the British would try to make another landing somewhere on the Empire's coasts. He wanted his coast guards and fortress troops to be ready to face the redcoats, at least on a short-term basis, until more professional troops could arrive. These preparations may have led to some modest improvements, but the imperial fortress and coast guard troops were mostly known for insubordination and colluding with smugglers. There were also the artillery trains. These were convoys of wagons that traveled with every Napoleonic artillery unit, carrying ammunition, spare parts, the equipment of the artillery support staff, and even spare cannons. Although they were perpetually in short supply, on paper, a Napoleonic army of this period kept one spare cannon in the artillery train for every 10 in the field. At least in theory, every object in every French artillery unit, down to the smallest screw, had at least one spare waiting in the artillery train. There is even a story of a one-legged artillery officer keeping a spare wooden leg in the artillery train. The artillery trains were separate organizations, not a part of the regular artillery regiments. At the start of each campaign, every artillery company in the army was assigned a corresponding artillery train company. The men even wore different uniforms from the rest of the artillery, a sort of light blue-gray with dark blue accents. In the recent past, the artillery train had been composed of civilian contractors, professional drivers hired fresh for each campaign, and not subject to military discipline. They were fully professionalized under Napoleon. In fact, this was one of his very first military reforms. The coup of Brumaire took place in early November 1799, and these new professional artillery trains were announced in January of 1800. Clearly, the little corporal had come into office with this idea already in his back pocket. Setting up professional artillery trains required a large upfront investment of money and bureaucratic resources, but Napoleon was very pleased with the results. He would later brag that by not having to hire contractors, the army saved 2 million francs a year. They certainly performed well. The old civilian contractors had been disorganized and flighty. They tended to abandon their posts at the first sign of trouble, and sometimes didn't return. When they were actually on the job, they were not very efficient. This professional artillery train was one of the things that set the French artillery apart from less well-organized services in other countries. Thanks to their excellent artillery trains, generally speaking, the French were better supplied, their guns were better maintained, and they even had access to more ammunition on the battlefield. This could make a big difference. It was very common for artillery batteries of this era to suddenly stop firing because they had run out of shot or gunpowder. Many of the men of the artillery train were veterans of frontline service. It was not a combat role, but familiarity with army life and organization was important, as was skill with handling horses. The artillery train was attractive to men who had retired from regular service but wanted to keep earning a paycheck, or men who had been too badly wounded to see any more combat but did not want to leave the army. Some of the artillery train men were ex-soldiers of enemy armies. This was one of the preferred destinations for defectors, a place where their skills might be useful, but they would be unable to do much damage if their new loyalties proved to be unreliable. Apparently, Prussians and Spaniards were particularly common. Working in the artillery train was a tough job. As we've seen in many past episodes, French armies of this era had to cross all kinds of difficult terrain. The artillery train was expected to follow wherever the army went, with their ponderously heavy wagons and temperamental teams of horses. Although they were technically non-combatants, the men did take on risk. In several past episodes, we've seen artillery shots hit ammunition wagons. These lucky shots could create terrifying explosions. As you might imagine, the men driving those wagons would have had zero chance of surviving. Still, they were relatively safe compared to the gunners they supplied. An artillery battery was always a target on the battlefield, both of counter-battery fire from enemy cannons and of assaults from enemy infantry or cavalry. Casualties could be heavy. At the Battle of Friedland in 1807, the French artillery spent most of the battle outgunned by their Russian opponents, then brought up their cannons to within 60 paces of the enemy at the climax of the battle. In the end, Napoleon won a smashing victory, but his gunners suffered 50% casualties. 2 years later, at Wagram, Napoleon grouped much of his artillery together in a single huge battery of over 100 guns. This concentration of firepower made them a very powerful force, but also a tempting target for the Austrians, who had the advantage of elevation. Casualties among the gunners of this huge battery were so heavy, Napoleon was forced to go into his reserve and call for volunteers from the infantry of the Old Guard to bolster their numbers. Although they did the vast majority of their fighting at long range with their cannons, artillerymen were issued personal weapons. In the French military, the foot artillery carried muskets, usually with the barrel shortened to make them lighter and less awkward, and a shortened saber. These swords were not very useful in combat, and apparently were more commonly used as utility knives than as weapons. Just like with their uniforms, the horse artillery were equipped more like cavalry troopers, with sabers and pistols. Of course, if artillerymen were close enough to the enemy to actually use these weapons, Something had gone wrong. No commander of this era, however incompetent, would have actually ordered his gunners to fight up close. However, as we've seen countless times in past episodes, artillery batteries were overrun all the time. Sometimes the gunners did stand and fight. We saw a great example of this in episode 117, when we discussed the famous charge of the Polish Lancers at the Battle of Somosierra. During this engagement, it seems most of the Spanish gun crews held their ground and engaged the Poles in close combat. Artillerymen who were inclined to fight might do so with their personal weapons, but there are also accounts of them using their tools as weapons. Many of these tools were at the end of long staves, because they had to reach all the way to the end of a cannon barrel, and thus could be used as impromptu spears or fighting staffs in a pinch. I would guess a lot of gunners were more comfortable wielding these tools than their weapons, which they would have had little cause to use during their service. With all that said, going toe-to-toe with enemy infantry or cavalry was definitely not the norm for Napoleonic-era artillerymen. If they were overrun, the gunners and their officers typically ducked and covered under their cannons, waiting for the enemy to pass them by or be driven off by a counterattack so they could go back into action. It was perhaps not the most glorious maneuver, but these men had little experience or training in close combat, and they were tremendously valuable for their skills with their cannons, so it was logical. However, this might help explain why the artillery service was not considered very glamorous compared to the rest of the army, and why the gunners were sometimes derided by their comrades in the infantry and cavalry. The basic building block of the artillery was the company, a much smaller group than the other branches of the service. The battalions of an infantry regiment were typically split up, but it was very rare to find an infantry company without the rest of its battalion somewhere nearby. By contrast, artillery companies almost never fought alongside the rest of their regiment. An artillery regiment was really more of an administrative construct than a real, cohesive military unit. A single regiment might find its various companies scattered across the entire continent, none within 100 miles of any of the others. On paper, a French artillery company was just shy of 150 men. Although in the field, that number was often quite a bit lower. Each company was supposed to have 8 guns, although in practice, 6 or 7 was quite common, and there were sometimes as few as 4. Artillery companies had a reputation for being tight-knit. I wonder if serving in these comparatively small units had something to do with that. Sometimes, artillery companies were broken up, and each gun was assigned to a specific infantry unit to serve under the direct command of the infantry officers. This was referred to as the regimental artillery. The idea was to give the infantry a little extra firepower, and a way for them to quickly overcome any unexpected obstacles, like buildings or fortifications, without having to send back a messenger to request cannons or engineers. It was perhaps not a bad idea in principle, but the regimental artillery was not very efficient in practice. The regular field artillery companies needed cannons much more urgently than the infantry, so their needs always took first priority. Infantry units that were supposed to have regimental artillery attached on paper often had to go without in practice. The innovation of horse artillery also made the regimental artillery somewhat redundant. Part of the point of the horse artillery was that they could ride out quickly to wherever they were needed. It was much more efficient to keep a centralized reserve of horse artillery than to try to disperse out cannons to the entire infantry. Some French infantry units did hold on to their regimental artillery as late as 1812, but by the height of Napoleon's rule, the concept was clearly on the way out. The decline of the regimental artillery is representative of a broader shift in artillery doctrine during this period. In past eras of history, artillery was seen as having essentially 2 uses, providing supplemental firepower to the infantry and cavalry, and battering down hard obstacles like buildings or fortifications. By the Napoleonic period, artillery was coming into its own. Commanders were coming to see it as more than just an adjunct to the infantry and cavalry, but rather as a key component of any army, just as important as the other two branches of the service, with its own unique tactical uses. The key to this new school of artillery warfare was massing cannons together. A small handful of cannons could be very dangerous to any enemy forces in the immediate area, but given their inaccuracy and slow rate of fire, a few cannons scattered here and there would be unlikely to have any measurable impact on a battle involving tens of thousands of soldiers. On the other hand, large numbers of cannon, all massed together, were capable of dominating entire areas of a battlefield. Depending on the situation, a Napoleonic commander might place dozens of cannons in the same area, sometimes over 100. These large formations are sometimes referred to as grand batteries, or massed batteries. On the defensive, large concentrations of artillery were capable of holding part of the line, or blunting an enemy attack. Or they could be used on the offensive, severely weakening or even dispersing the units in some part of an enemy line, creating a hole that could then be exploited by infantry or cavalry. You might recall that at the Battle of Wagram, when Napoleon had to reposition his forces to face a threat to his left flank, he brought forward several artillery units to hold the part of the line temporarily vacated by Massena's infantry, which they did successfully. Whenever possible, Bonaparte kept a central reserve of horse artillery, which could be deployed rapidly in these types of situations. I'm not sure it would have occurred to generals of past generations to use artillery in this way, as a piece on the battlefield chessboard in their own right, not merely as support units to the other parts of the army. So far, we've been focusing on the French artillery and general observations about the state of the service at the turn of the 19th century. But what about the other great powers? How did they stack up against the gunners of the Grande Armée? Military historians who study this era seem more or less unanimous in rating the French artillery as the best in the world, which is worth noting because historians often do not agree. There also seems to be consensus that the runners-up were the gunners of the Russian artillery. Russia had huge resources, and the imperial government had made its artillery arm a major national priority, going back decades before the start of our story. As I've mentioned in past episodes, Russia was at war almost constantly throughout this period, so just like the men of the French artillery, Russian gunners had a lot of battlefield experience, and a lot of opportunities to hone their skills. Like the French, the Russian artillery service saw itself as an elite within the army. Unlike the French, the Russian gunners seem to have put a great premium on personal bravery, even to the point of foolishness. They were notorious for standing and fighting when their positions were overrun, which is perhaps commendable on some level, but often resulted in them being cut down. Like in the Grande Armée, Russian artillery uniforms were very similar to those worn by their infantry, dark green with black hats. Despite having numerous well-built cannons and tough, experienced gunners, the Russian leadership had not been happy with the performance of their artillery in the campaign of 1805, which had culminated in their defeat at Austerlitz. The individual Russian gun crews had performed well. The problems were at the top: poor organization, poor leadership, and outdated doctrine. The responsibility for correcting these deficiencies fell to the Inspector General of the Russian Artillery Service, a remarkable character named Count Alexey Arakcheyev. The Count was an absolute tyrant, feared by the whole Russian officer corps, not only the artillery. He was very intelligent and generally fair, but had incredibly high standards and was merciless in enforcing them. Arakcheyev makes a memorable appearance in Tolstoy's War and Peace, which depicts his staff as being afraid to even speak at a normal volume in his presence, in case they aroused his notorious temper. After Austerlitz, Arakcheyev embarked on an ambitious program of reform, ruthlessly cutting out the dead wood from the officer corps and imposing his high standards across the entire service. It won him few friends within the artillery. He almost became something of a boogeyman figure among the junior officers. There were all kinds of urban legends and tall tales about the barbaric punishments he supposedly administered to the men who fell short of his standards. However, even his critics had to admit he was effective. Under Arakcheyev's despotic rule, the organization, doctrine, and leadership of the Russian artillery began to match its excellent weapons and gunners. By 1807, foreign observers had begun to take notice. Some historians claim that by the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the Russian artillery service had begun to eclipse the French. Despite, or perhaps because of his harsh methods, Emperor Alexander and the Russian court took notice of Arakcheyev. Later in the 19th century, the Count would become one of the Emperor's most trusted subordinates. He was one of the chief architects of the Russian military of the 19th century. After the Russians, the most highly regarded artillery service in Europe was probably that of the Habsburg Empire. The Austrian artillery had been the best in the continent in the mid-18th century. Their successes inspired their rivals to make reforms, resulting in the French and Russian artillery surpassing the Austrians by the Napoleonic period. In fact, the French artillery system, which we discussed in our very early episodes, known as the Gribeval system, was actually based on the earlier Austrian Liechtenstein system. You see this dynamic all the time in the history of warfare. Failure breeds innovation, and success breeds complacency. But that's not to say the Austrian artillery wasn't any good. Much like the Russians, their individual gun crews were experienced and quite capable. Their deficiencies were mostly in organization and doctrine. Like the French and the Russians, the Austrian artillery saw themselves as an elite within the army. They enjoyed high morale, professionalism, and esprit de corps, which were sometimes lacking in other parts of the Austrian army. Unlike the rest of the Habsburg military, the men were all volunteers. Literacy in standard German was a requirement for joining the artillery, meaning the vast majority of the gunners were recruited from the majority German-speaking regions of the empire. I would guess that the fact that the men all came from similar backgrounds and roughly the same area contributed to their esprit de corps. The Austrian artillery was somewhat set apart from the rest of the military, and that was reflected in their uniforms as well as their attitude. Unlike the French and Russians, Habsburg artillerymen wore completely different clothing from every other branch of the service, a very unusual shade of copper brown, a color you don't really see in uniforms of this era. In their drab brown uniforms, the gunners of the Austrian military almost look like they could be from a century later. Unfortunately for the Austrians, but perhaps fortunately for their junior officers, the Habsburg Empire did not have any figure comparable to Russia's Count Arakcheyev to impose reforms on the artillery and weed out incapable officers. As in every other part of the Habsburg army, Archduke Charles tried to reform the artillery, but his more modern approach was often resisted by conservative officers. One interesting and perhaps amusing aspect of the Habsburg artillery service was their version of horse artillery. They were unique among the great powers in that when the Austrian horse artillery was on the move, each gun crew rode on a specially built gun carriage that came with a sort of long built-in saddle. The whole crew would pile on and sit in a line, one behind the other. If you imagine two people riding on a motorcycle, then imagine a motorcycle long enough for six or eight people to share the seat, you have some idea what it looked like. Obviously, it was pretty ridiculous, and the men of the Austrian artillery gave this vehicle a fittingly ridiculous name, the Wurst, or sausage, because the long leather seat looked like a giant sausage. The French actually experimented with the Wurst, but found that although it did reduce the number of horses needed for each artillery unit, the Wursts were slow. The whole point of horse artillery was speed, so they were not widely adopted in France. Despite their limitations, the artillery was one of the gems of the Habsburg military. Even in the campaign of 1805, when the Austrian infantry and cavalry seemed totally outmatched by the French, and morale was at an all-time low, the artillery maintained its high standards, and mostly preserved its dignity. Individual Austrian gun crews were excellent. When their commanders gave them the chance, they could be very effective. Think back to the storm of cannonballs that devastated the Grande Armée as it retreated from Aspern-Essling, killing Marshal Lannes. The British artillery did not enjoy quite the same prestige as their continental counterparts. Their quality was not particularly bad, but they lacked that sense of themselves as a small, elite band of brothers that seems to have been prevalent in so many of their rival services. According to observers at the time, the British gunners seemed to have lagged slightly behind the Austrians and Russians in skill. I'm sure a big part of that was experience. The Russians and Austrians had been at war constantly during this period, whereas the British ground forces had comparatively few chances to get practical experience, until they became involved in the Peninsular War in 1808. Even then, the British forces in Spain and Portugal were quite small. I have to wonder if the prestige of the Royal Navy might have played a role here too. The Navy would have attracted the same type of cerebral, forward-thinking, mathematically inclined men who might have been excellent artillery officers had they been born on the continent. There was also the fact that the British Army did not practice merit-based promotion. Officers achieved rank based on seniority and the purchasing of commissions. This system was a drag on the entire army, but the artillery most of all, because technical expertise was a huge part of artillery leadership, and it was not taken into account at all in the promotion of officers. Still, the British artillery had some key advantages. Foreign observers marveled at the quality of manufacturing in their weapons and equipment, which even surpassed the French and Russians. The British were also at the cutting edge of technical innovation. We've discussed their use of rockets in past episodes, which were actually not an entirely new technology, but had only recently been adapted to modern European warfare. The British rockets had a mixed reputation. Some officers valued them very highly. Others seem to have considered them more of a gimmick, only really useful for their ability to set fires from afar, which had limited applications outside of naval combat and sieges. The most famous British commander of this era, the Duke of Wellington, was not a believer in the rocket. He requested a rocket unit be sent to the peninsula to join his army, but later admitted he had only done so to get his hands on their horses, which were in short supply. In the Duke's own inimitable words, quote, "The effectiveness of the rocket is limited to employment against uncivilized natives and Americans." End quote. The British gunners also had another secret weapon, which was much more effective, a newly developed munition called the shrapnel shell. The word shrapnel has entered the English language as a common noun, but it comes from the name of a British artillery officer who served during this era, Henry Shrapnel, the inventor of this deadly device. Shrapnel's shell was a cross between a traditional cannonball and canister shot. We've discussed canister shot in past episodes. It was like a giant shotgun shell, enabling a cannon to fire a wide blast of small projectiles. Canister fire was incredibly deadly, but only effective at very short range. The shrapnel shell looked like a cannonball, but was stuffed with small projectiles, similar to a canister round. It would travel through the air like a normal cannonball for some set distance, then detonate mid-air, allowing British gunners to achieve the devastating effect of canister fire from much longer range. The French were very impressed with the shrapnel shell, and were eventually able to capture several examples of unfired shells for study, but were unable to get them into production before the end of the Napoleonic Wars. During this show, I often refer to the British forces euphemistically as redcoats, but that is just a figure of speech. Many British units, particularly outside the infantry, did not wear red. Most of the artillery actually wore blue, a color we usually associate with their French and American enemies. We've now talked about the French, the Russians, the Austrians, and the British. That leaves the Prussians with the title of worst artillery of the major belligerents of the Napoleonic Wars. Since long before the beginning of our story, the backbone of the Prussian army had been its infantry. The general attitude seems to have been that, although obviously every army needed cavalry and artillery, it was the infantry that won wars. And so, the main priority of the government and military should be the infantry. The Prussian gunners did not enjoy the same prestige and sense of mission that was prevalent in the services of the other Continental powers. As we've discussed in past episodes, before Jena and Auerstedt, the Prussian military had trouble moving on from the mindset of the mid-18th century, when King Frederick the Great was seen as the undisputed master of war. As we've discussed, at that time, artillery was seen as little more than an adjunct to the infantry and cavalry, and a specialized tool for attacking walls, buildings, or fortifications, rather than as an equal branch of the service with its own unique capabilities. The older generation of Prussian officers clung hard to their Frederickian views, but times had changed quite a bit. Old Fritz himself had been dead and buried for decades, and so had his style of warfare. And so, just like the rest of the military, the Prussian artillery was woefully unprepared when the Grande Armée came calling in 1806. And, just like the rest of the military, much of the Prussian artillery service was destroyed. The defeats at Jena and Auerstedt, and the other disasters of 1806, represented a powerful wake-up call. It was immediately clear to many in the Prussian leadership that they desperately needed to reform and modernize. However, before they could even think about reforming the artillery service, they had to rebuild it practically from scratch. Then they were hampered by the terms of the Treaty of Tilsit, which placed strict limits on the strength of the Prussian army, including the number of artillerymen, which was capped at just 6,000. It wasn't until much later in the Napoleonic Wars that the Prussian military was free to build a new artillery arm as they saw fit. And by that stage, they were decades behind all their rivals. One issue was the lack of emphasis on accuracy. The Prussian leadership judged its gunners by how fast they could fire and reload, and how fast they could limber and unlimber their pieces, not by their ability to place shots on target. Obviously, speed was vitally important on the battlefield, but the more highly regarded artillery services of this era all placed at least some emphasis on accuracy. The French and the Russians engaged in extensive artillery practice, another thing that set them apart from their rivals. Some individual Prussian gun crews were quite skilled. With better organization and doctrine, perhaps they could have become a force to be reckoned with. The Prussian service would eventually catch up with the artillery services of the other great powers, but not before the end of our story. Prussian gunners wore dark midnight blue uniforms with black hats, just like the infantry, perhaps a reflection of the fact that this service was something of an afterthought for the Prussian leadership. At least up until the very end of the Napoleonic Wars, when they were possibly equaled by the Russians, no artillery in the world came close to matching the French. In examining the success of the Grande Armée during its heyday, people often gravitate towards romantic explanations, their high morale and fighting spirit, and the internal culture of daring. In French accounts, both modern and contemporary, you often see the same word cropping up again and again, cran, meaning guts or grit. The French military of this era certainly had a lot of cran, but I think a close look at the artillery showcases some of the less romantic strengths of the Grande Armée. They were incredibly well organized, to the point that it's hard to imagine how they managed such sophisticated systems without the benefit of any advanced communication or computation technology. Imagine it was your job to ensure every French army unit in every corner of Europe, from Portugal to Ukraine and from Denmark to Croatia, had exactly the right number of each size of artillery wheel. Imagine trying to coordinate this with only a small staff, no computers, and no ability to send a message faster than a man on a galloping horse. To the administrators of the French artillery, this was just another day at the office. The men in the field were even more impressive, taking on the same types of complex organizational tasks as their comrades behind the lines, along with all the other leadership and administrative duties of a military officer. On the battlefield, they solved geometry problems in their heads while enemy cannonballs rained down on them. Once Napoleon took command of the Army of Italy, he was no longer considered an artillery officer. Army leaders were seen as above the inter-service divisions that defined the rest of the military. But I think it's safe to say he remained an artillery officer in spirit for his entire life. His skills in organization and logistics, attention to detail, analytical mindset, relentless work ethic, and even his hard-headedness and independence are all traits associated with artillery officers. Even as Emperor of the French, he always paid special attention to his home branch of the army, sometimes to the chagrin of the other services. I hope by now it goes without saying that Napoleon was by far the most iconic figure to emerge from this turbulent era of history. However, if you browse through books about Napoleonic militaries or art depicting Napoleonic warfare, you see a lot more of the infantry and cavalry than you do of Napoleon's own branch of the army. Historical fiction set in this era is full of dashing cavalrymen, stalwart infantry officers, and daring mariners, but I can't think of a single iconic Napoleonic artilleryman from novels, films, or television, unless you count the Emperor himself. People sometimes like to think of the Napoleonic Wars as the last gasp of a forgotten world. The last major war in which bravery and guts and chivalry was more important than more modern and prosaic things like manufacturing capabilities and logistics and technical know-how. That is a very limited view in a lot of ways, but first and foremost for our purposes here, the modern style of bureaucratic, mechanized warfare was already coming into being during this period. The artillery was at the forefront of those changes, which I think is why artists and creators of historical fiction, and even non-fiction writers, sometimes shy away from the artillery. The terrible killing power of the artillery, and the unromantic way in which it was run, are reminders that real warfare is dirtier and colder than any painting or adventure story. However unromantic it may have been, the artillery of this era was indeed a harbinger of the future of warfare. As I mentioned earlier in this episode, a typical Napoleonic battle would see 10 to 20% of casualties caused by artillery, with an absolute maximum of about 33%. Only 100 years later, during the First World War, well over half of casualties in a typical European battle were inflicted by the artillery, sometimes as much as 75%. The gunners of the Napoleonic era witnessed the early stages of a military revolution that would make war deadlier than ever, and arguably transform its very nature. Napoleonic gunners would have found the technology used by their First World War counterparts completely alien, but I think their outlook would have been very familiar. That's all for now. For those of you who are signed up on Patreon, make sure to get in your questions for the next bonus episode in the comment section of the previous bonus episode. As for the rest of you, I hope you'll consider joining us. Otherwise, I'll be back to you in 1 month with more from the main narrative. As always, thanks for listening.